This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll have an update on the medical status of political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Shockingly, on our host Heidi Boghossian's visit, he was not in the prison where he was supposed to be.
We'll talk with journalist and filmmaker John Pilger about his article, Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue.
And he's talking about American fascism. And he's talking about 69 countries that have suffered at the hands of American modern fascism.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Last Monday, my friend and colleague Johanna Fernandez and I went to see Mumia because we were very concerned about his declining health.
You were out in Pennsylvania.
We went to Fraxville, Pennsylvania, to the correctional institution SCI Mahanoy, where he's been for a couple of years.
How long a drive is that?
It takes about 3 hours, and although getting out of Manhattan takes a while. So we arrived there, I'd say, around noon, a little later than we planned, because you like to get there before the count when they shut things down for a while. And we were excited because we hadn't seen him in a couple of months, but when we got to the desk, we were told that he wasn't there. And we had to call in the day before to let them know we were coming. We're both on his visitors list. So at the time, we didn't know there was anything wrong. But the guard told us that he had been rushed to a local health facility and that he was there and would be out. We didn't know how long. So Johanna and I ran into another colleague in the parking lot who immediately called Mumia's wife, Wadia, because only immediate family members would be authorized to speak to him. And Wadia reported, she called the prison and reported that they said he'd been rushed in what they described then as what seemed like a diabetic shock, I think they said. And they gave her the name of the facility. So Johanna and I hopped in the car, drove to Pottsville, which is a nearby town, found the facility. And as we were parking, we saw a woman on the street and we asked her where the critical unit was because they had told Wadia he was in critical care. We went into the building, kind of ominous building, and we took the elevator straight up to the fourth floor. And we went through the waiting room and no one was there. So even though it said a sign telling you to stop, we actually went right in and we went up to the nurse's desk where we saw four police officers standing guard outside the room, which we determined was Mumia's, right behind the nurse's station. And we asked to speak to the head nurse. We were told they couldn't obviously give us information, although we pressed them and said, look, you know, we're an attorney and a member of the prison, the Pennsylvania Prison Society, which Johanna is, which means we each can go on very short notice to visit inmates. And have been going for years and said that we were really concerned and just wanted to make sure he was okay. They wouldn't tell us anything. We left and we went into the hallway and were deliberating what to do when a couple of them came out and told us we had to leave the entire building. So we left the building, but then we ran into some Mumia supporters who had found out we were there because we'd called, and there had been, as you know, the hearing, the trial for the what we're calling the silence, the prisoners, you know, law that was created specifically to silence Mumia. Well, that hearing was being held in Harrisburg that morning. So Pam Africa, Brett Grody, who's been on this show, one of his attorneys, actually drove up in a van and came to the hospital. And we tried yet again to see if we could gain admittance, and we're told we couldn't. And Mumia's brother, Keith Cook, was there.
And what were you told was wrong with Mumia?
We weren't told anything because that would violate the HIPAA privacy laws, but they had told Wadia that he had gone into apparently insulin or diabetic shock. So we were very concerned because we knew that he had been getting sicker and sicker over the last 2 to 3 months. He's been fatigued. He actually fell asleep and missed a certain, I think, meal deadline and was written up for that in the prison. He's had a rash all over his body. He was spent a week in the infirmary at the hospital, but did not get better. And actually, Johanna and I were going there with forms that he could sign to request seeing an outside doctor, because he had seen physicians within the facility. They'd given him some medicine that seemed to actually make him sicker. He was very bloated. He felt terrible. Johanna spoke with him on the phone the Friday night before we went and said he sounded very different, and he was also depressed.
I understand that they had taken three blood tests on three different dates, and had they done that properly, it would have indicated that he had diabetes. Because he didn't even know that he had diabetes.
No, that's right, Michael. And clearly, I mean, what this points to, obviously, is the gross inadequacy of medical care for inmates. Yes. I mean, it's happening to Mumia. He has a huge following, so we can talk about this. But for the thousands, I read that an estimated 80,000 inmates in this country have diabetes. And that's people. We don't even know the countless others who may have another chronic illness and aren't being tested and aren't receiving medication to keep it in control. So it's a sorry indictment about the state of health care in these penal institutions.
Particularly, I read that he had a count of 760 or 780, and 800 would put him in a total coma.
Exactly.
So they came very close to killing him.
They came very close to killing him. And of course, we have to ask, had not Johanna and I planned for this visit, because Mumia, in typical Mumia fashion, doesn't like to talk about himself and doesn't like attention on things like this. So we were respecting his request that no one visit him over the last, I think it was 4 to 6 weeks, until Johanna realized how sick he sounded and was very concerned that he may be seriously declining, so decided to bring those forms in. Had we not done that, we might not have known for days or maybe even longer that Mumia had been taken out of there. And let's remind our listeners that recently we lost Phil Africa, who was admitted, had been incarcerated, a member of the MOVE family, and who died in an outside facility, but was shrouded in mystery, the conditions, no one was allowed to visit him.
They do that on purpose, because they think that if somebody's outside of the prison, there's a greater chance that they can escape. So that's why they didn't tell you. It was really lucky that you showed up there.
And it was lucky that people and supporters happened to be nearby in Harrisburg and mobilized so quickly to get to that facility. And his lawyers, Christina Swarns and Judy Ritter, also sent letters that day asking the lawyer for the Department of Corrections in Pennsylvania if Wadia, his wife, and his brother Keith Cook could visit him. And sure enough, when we taped the show, they had just gone in last week to visit him. Then what happens is, after Wadia and Keith had a short visit, saw that he was at least conscious and feeling a little better, although I understand he was still very fatigued, we hear that a new prison rule was issued last week that would prevent Wadia and Keith from visiting him again for an entire week. So we have what we call the Mumia exception. New prison rules that are created specifically with Mumia in mind, allowing only one visit per week per immediate family member. Hopefully, as of the time this program airs, he was able to have another visit, but it means that there will be a lapse in communication and monitoring his condition.
Well, it shows the cruelty of these people. This is a extremely serious, could be fatal condition.
Exactly.
And assuming that he survives this, diabetes is a terrible condition. It wears out your body.
And the organs.
Yeah, sure. My father died from complications of it. So this is a serious situation, not just in the immediate future, but in the future.
Right.
Because the prison medical system is so utterly inadequate that we're going to need help from all the people that know Mumia from this point on.
And another point, as we've covered on Law and Disorder, with the privatization of prisons across the nation, what you have is food service companies competing to make a profit and serving, we don't know what they serve, but we know it's high carbohydrate, you know, high sugar, high salt. I've heard many reports of food that's served to inmates that's perished.
Well, I just came back from visiting David Gilbert, a political prisoner in Auburn Prison. His friends and family send him food because the food is... It's a struggle if you're in prison to stay healthy.
But, Michael, you know, in many facilities, you're not allowed to receive food. They rely on the commissary, which also is stocked with sugar, salt, and preservatives.
But what about the privatization of medical care? Is he getting... do they farm out the medical care in Pennsylvania?
That's a good question. I know that there were a couple of physicians in the facility that knew Mumia and had seen him over a period of time. So I think they'd been away for a while when he was sick. I don't know if they're privately contracted.
And what's the last word we heard on his condition as of now?
That his blood sugar had dropped. They visited him the day after he was admitted, and his blood sugar had dropped into the, I think, mid-300s, which is still, as I understand it, very high.
It's very serious. It's
supposed to be lower than 100.
How can we help?
Well, if Mumia is still in that facility as of when this airs, and you can go to a few websites to check to find out what the status is, including the campaign to bring Mumia home. Mumia also has a Facebook page for those of you who are on Facebook that's updated regularly. Find out whether he is still at that facility and whether he is being allowed visitors. Determine whether he's still in that facility, and if there are calls to contact the facility to try to have family members be allowed to visit him, just keep the pressure going. I think that there's no doubt letting the medical professionals and the DOC know that everyone is watching will have an enormous difference on the outcome of this.
I think that's crucial, Heidi, and I'm so glad you went. If you had not gone that day, we would never know.
Heidi, do you have any phone numbers?
Well, the phone numbers are posted on most of the websites, but SCI Mahanoy, where Mumia is usually housed, you should contact Superintendent John Carestes there and ask for him by name. That number is 570-773-2158, extension 8102. And the medical center where Mumia was is, and maybe still, depending on when this airs, is 570-621-5000. Now, you should know that they were denying he was there when people called. He was apparently listed under his former name of Wesley Cook. Don't know why they did that.
Well, they do that because they want to thwart any kind of plan to escape.
Right. But even when people asked for Wesley Cook, they were told he wasn't there. So just keep calling. Yeah. Keep up the pressure. Write letters if you want. Send faxes. I think everything
helps. Will you give me that phone number of the superintendent one more time? I want to call him.
Let's all call him. It's 570-773-2158, extension 1802, that's Superintendent Carestes.
Why don't we call him right from here?
Let's call him from here.
Michael, we've talked about the possibility of Palestine joining the International Criminal Court and its ramifications. Well, last week they joined it. What do you think?
Well, to be exact, they joined it or tried to join it 90 days before April 1st. We're recording this particular segment on April 1st. April 1st is the 90th day, and on that day, they officially have now joined the International Criminal Court. Israel, of course, has not joined the International Criminal Court, and of course, neither has the United States. But the International Criminal Court does have jurisdiction over the occupied territories, over what happened in Gaza, over what's happened in the Golan Heights, and over what's happening in the West Bank. And the prosecutor in the International Criminal Court is considering war crimes for what happened in Gaza in 2014. She could also consider the continuous building of settlements in the occupied territories, because that is a war crime under Geneva Conventions. You're prohibited from moving your civilians from your territory or your country into the occupied territory. That complaint hasn't yet been made by the Palestinians, but of course that is a major one because it's a continuing violation. It's going on forever. It's going on as we speak. And so that's another one. While it's not a be-all and end-all step, it's certainly an important step, and it was important enough so that Israel, for a period of time, upheld almost all its payments to the Palestinian Authority, payments of
that belong to the Palestinian Authority, their customs duties, et cetera, that are collected for going through borders. They've now released some of them. The United States also condemned the joining of the ICC back when we did the show a few months ago. But we'll see. It's going to be an interesting thing to see because, you know, you did have the figures on Gaza that we talked about before were extraordinary in terms of the number of people killed. It was something like 2,400 Palestinians were killed.
Including 500 children.
500 children. And the numbers, of course, of Israelis killed was minuscule compared to that. So that if there's war crimes here, the majority, if not 95% of the blame is going to be placed squarely on the Israelis.
Well, the children were killed in schools, and those schools were intentionally targeted. And the Israeli lobby in the UN is mounting a ferocious campaign so that they won't be listed as having done that.
So we'll look forward to seeing whether the ICC, which has been notoriously political in the sense that so far it's only indicted 36 African dictators or African heads of state or whatever, we'll see if it actually go outside of its favorite punching bag and actually do something about what's happened in the occupied territories.
Michael, we've got a situation that harkens back to the Hobby Lobby case with the misuse of the concept of religious freedom. What do you make of it?
You know, we covered the Hobby Lobby case on our show of July 7, 2014, and that was the case in which a closely held but major important big corporation called Hobby Lobby, but closely held by a single family, said that they didn't want to pay the part of Obamacare that would pay for four types of abortion or four types of preventive pregnancy ways for women, the IUD being one. You would have thought, well, that's just silly. That's not what they meant under the initial federal law having to do with religious freedom. It was about indigenous people being able to smoke peyote, things like that. But the Supreme Court, amazingly, in a 5-4 decision, as we talked about last year, said that that closely held corporation didn't have to pay for abortion services or really birth control prevention services as part of Obamacare. And Justice Ginsburg gave a blistering 35-page dissent, which I recall, Michael Smith, you had spent some time talking about here, saying this was just a minefield, that you didn't know what was going to happen next with this. Was it going to be next like a closely held corporation by Jehovah's Witnesses, no more blood transfusions for people? And she went on with a whole long list of what could happen. Well, now the Hobby Lobby case has spawned these two states, as you referred to them, Indiana and Arkansas, beginning to get into the Hobby Lobby business, but in a draconian way. At the bottom of the new so-called religious freedom laws being passed by states is really they don't want to have to serve gay people or same-sex couples. They don't want to have to give them housing in these legislators. They don't want to give them employment, and they don't want to have them in public accommodations, essentially. So they've passed these so-called state religious freedom acts. And what they say is that any for-profit business can, if it has religious scruples against doing whatever, it doesn't say gays, obviously, but it says whatever religious scruples they have, they can listen to their conscience on religious scruples and refuse to give that person employment, refuse to house them, etc. So it cuts completely against every anti-discrimination law in the country, as well as allowing people's religious beliefs to rule, overrule fundamental laws against discrimination. And what the laws do, one, they allow you to do that, to refuse to serve someone if they're gay, for example, or if they're a same-sex couple, but it also is a defense to a lawsuit. So let's say you and I go into a restaurant, we're a gay couple, same-sex couple, we don't get served, and we bring a lawsuit under whatever the state law is that says you have to serve us, a public accommodation or a restaurant, whatever. And it's a defense to that lawsuit that you have a religious scruple against serving or against having same-sex couples in your restaurant. So those two laws are now on the books. They're draconian, or they're at least, yeah, they are on the books, and they're in the process of getting a huge pushback, which is a good thing to say, that lots of people are canceling everything to Indiana, lectures, everything else.
Basketball tournaments.
Basketball, everything, and it's going to happen in Alabama as well. So I think there's going to be enough of a pushback, because now even some of these conservative Republican people, and even the governor in this case of Alabama, is saying he wants the law changed. He's not saying he can do it, but he wants it changed, which is to say he's not saying that the legislature, which is very conservative, is going to do it, but he's saying he won't enforce it, et cetera, et cetera. So we're in an amazing moment, but it reminds you of what Ruth Ginsburg said, that what they did in Hobby Lobby was a minefield. And I think we'll keep bringing you updates on this because it's an important issue. And we pointed out before that, yes, it's about religious freedom, supposedly, these laws. But in fact, as we said before, it was about women, women's rights in general, women's rights to be able to not become pregnant, to have birth control, and also, obviously, about sexuality, gays, genders, etc. So, in fact, they're clothed in the words of religion, but they're about discrimination in its worst forms.
Michael, Obama issued an executive order about hackers last week. What's it all about?
Well, we're just going to start explaining it, and perhaps in the next couple of weeks we'll get a guest on about it. But what he did is declare a national emergency and issued a new executive order on hackers, what he calls in the executive order, quote, malicious cyber-enabled activities. And it allows the Treasury Department of the United States to sanction hackers and those associated with them or supporting them. In other words, you don't have to go to court to get a criminal conviction of anybody. The Treasury Department can list various people, seize their assets, etc., either if people are hackers or those associated with them or supporting them. And some of the big fears about this law are take WikiLeaks, for example, or take other people. WikiLeaks, for example, just published material on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They, I'm sure, did not participate in hacking or getting that material by hacking, but were furnished that material in some way or other and then published it. And the law may be written, or the executive order may be written broadly enough where they could claim that by publishing it, they're somehow aiding the hackers or harming the national security or economic security of the United States, and therefore even prosecute journalists such as WikiLeaks, whether it's WikiLeaks or any other journalist who's doing something like that.
They'd have to show under the law that WikiLeaks solicited the hacking. But what you're saying is that if they're passive receivers of the product of the hacking, they could be gone after. So that escalates the fight.
Right. And it wouldn't just be WikiLeaks. It would be obviously other journalists. And exactly what you're saying. Right now, you'd have to prove they were conspirators with the hackers or something like that. This you could be, and it's just in today, so I don't want to give a final analysis of this law. It could be that if you simply publish material that's to the economic detriment of the United States, that they could say and list, they could list you under this law as essentially saying we seize your assets and you can't have any financial transactions with this person, etc. So we'll get more, we'll do more about it as we go on, but it's a serious blow at First Amendment freedoms.
We speak today with John Pilger, who is one of the world's renowned investigative journalists and documentary filmmakers. He's known for his conscience and bravery and acute historical insight. We talked to him about his recent article in Counterpunch magazine titled, Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue. Using the word carefully, Pilger describes a new kind of fascism centered in America, but based on the big lie and a wars of aggression. We get a historical perspective from Pilger going all the way back to the end of the Second World War. If you think the wars in Yugoslavia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and now the Ukraine happened by happenstance, you are mistaken, says Pilger. These are part of an American effort to become the global power. John Pilger has worked in many facets of journalism, including as a correspondent in the Vietnam War, the Middle East desk for Reuters in London, and a producer for the Independent Television Network in London. His articles appear worldwide in newspapers such as The Guardian, The Independent, The New York Times, and The Los Angeles Times.
John Pilger, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
John, we were intrigued and excited
both to talk to you about a new article that you wrote that appeared in Counterpunch called Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue. And yeah. It was an extraordinary article, really summing up, I think you would say, since 1945, what the United States in particular has been doing around the world. And if you could begin by maybe giving us your overall thesis of that article and why you're talking about it as a form of fascism.
Well, I think it's about definitions, and it's about the way we look back on fascism and its Nazi iconography. I mean, I've always been very cautious about using the term fascism because it is so associated with Nazism, but it does apply to the rampant role of United States administrations and their allies since 1945. I mean, actual fascism that is very much like Nazi fascism was set up throughout Latin America, first in Brazil, then on to Chile and Argentina, and right through that suffering continent, Nazi fascism was created by the United States, and of course throughout Central America as well. But a more, let's say, subtle kind of fascism is an insidious kind of fascism, now runs right through U.S. policy, especially as its dominance is challenged. It was always there, but now that its dominance is challenged by two powers, not as great as the United States, but one certainly in economic terms rapidly becoming great, and that's China, challenged to some degree by Russia, but challenged most of all by the fact that we're in a period where the old imperial neo-colonial period is being seriously challenged by a post-colonial period. I mean, that's exactly what this new invasion of Yemen is about. If you look at all the countries that are lining up with their U.S. weapons and U.S. logistics and U.S. backing to attack this impoverished, divided country, they are all colonial creations either of the earlier powers like Britain and France or of the United States. Saudi Arabia is the absolute epitome of this. So that, as I see it, is what the present state of the world is. It is we're moving into a struggle between basic, almost 19th century imperialism and its hangover, and something of a new order. That new order, we don't know exactly what it is, but it's represented by new economic powers such as China, undoubtedly a resurgent Russia. I mean, the fear of Iran is really that Iran is at the center of this new order. Not that it's backing countries like Yemen, which it isn't, but that it has refused to surrender its independence. So it is colonial societies, colonial-backed countries versus these new orders that has produced this almost ferocity that is now becoming a kind of fascism everywhere. The overthrow of the government in Kiev in Ukraine, although turned upside down by Western propaganda, was part of that. The fact that Obama has lied that he's leaving Afghanistan when in fact he's staying in Afghanistan. And as I say, this new war in Yemen. War and aggression is the essence of fascism. The Nazis certainly demonstrated that to us. And the disregard, of course, for human life, that is very much a feature of U.S. policy throughout the world.
And you might want to add the big lie to that as well.
The big lie accompanies everything. it's the big lie and an insidious propaganda that inverts reality, inverts the truth. You know, most, for me now, and I've been a journalist for quite a few years, most television news, most news, in fact, is unwatchable because I then have to sit in front of it and deconstruct it or monitor it at the very least, that there is no option of gaining any information from it or knowledge from it.
Our guest is John Pilger. We're talking to him about his most recent article, Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue. We'll be back after this break. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with John Pilger about his recent article in Counterpunch, Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue.
So the big lie has insinuated itself right throughout the media. The big lie has worked in Afghanistan. The big lie worked now famously in Iraq. And we now know that probably about the same number of people died in Iraq as a result of that big lie as died in Rwanda. So fascism's lies and its aggression and its manipulations throughout the world, and manipulations, at one point something like a third of the third of the members of the United Nations, 69 nations, had been attacked by the United States. Sanctions, so-called sanctions, that rather benign word, has been imposed on more than a third, on more than a third of the world's populations in some form. So the lie plus violence plus threat plus manipulation adds up to a very modern, let's say, post-Nazi form of fascism. And I think it is absolutely appropriate now to use the word, if only to concentrate people now, those who understand and are worried by much of this, to concentrate their minds on what is happening in their world and to shake people away from the idea that fraudulent liberal leaders like Obama, who is one of the great liars and one of the real men of violence on the world stage, can solve this, can make this better. We're at a stage, I think, of critical self-awareness. Either we understand these movements, we may not be able to analyze it exactly and understand where it's going, but we understand these movements in the world, or we don't.
I'm tempted to ask you what the big lie was in a number of instances, Serbia, Libya, Iraq, Ukraine, Afghanistan, because they were all pulled off under the curtain of a big lie. And the other thing that I'd like to hear from you is what the real interests are that underlie the reason for the big lie. I don't know where to start because they've lied all over the world. You pick a place.
Well, you're right. It's a landscape. I think, in a way, it is making the connections, isn't it? And I suppose that's what I've tried to do in that article and other pieces, is to make the connections, which are glaringly obvious. I mean, you mentioned Libya. Okay. Now, in 2011, NATO, which is the basically the U.S. Enforcer, it has no legal basis whatsoever to roam around the world attacking countries, and it does it illegally, actually. It launched something, almost 10,000 so-called strike sorties against Libya, and even on its own statistics, a third of these were against civilian targets. It flattened two cities, Misurata and Sirte. They were carpet bombed. I mean, the attack on Libya was absolutely ferocious. Now, the big lie was expressed by Obama when he said that we knew that if we waited one more day, that Benghazi, a city the size of Charlotte, could suffer a massacre that would have reverberated across the region and stained the conscience of the world. Well, that was nonsense. There was no massacre in Benghazi, and the whole notion of the massacre was based on the fabrication of a group of Islamist militias who were just raring to, had been Gaddafi's opponents for years, were raring for the opportunity, were handed it, and gave it to the news media, specifically Reuters. It can go back to Reuters, that they said there was going to be a bloodbath, a massacre like we saw in Rwanda. That was enough. And the so-called humanitarian intervention then against Gaddafi was failed. Now, that was a big lie. I mean, Gaddafi, in fact, had had been going along with the boys in Washington and London and Paris and wanting really to get back into the game. But Gaddafi was always considered under grave suspicion because of his support for the real possibility of economic independence in Africa. He was prepared to use his massive oil wealth to underwrite with gold an African development bank, an African currency. Now, this was all very audacious and may never have happened. But certainly Obama apparently believed it because he went ahead and confiscated $30 billion from Libya's central bank, and that's what Gaddafi had earmarked to use in Africa. Now, if you look at Africa today, following that attack on Libya in 2011, the U.S., the gates of Africa virtually opened for the U.S. It was already there. AFRICOM, the U.S. command, had finally got into Addis Ababa, and right throughout Africa, we've seen these this mass bribing with money and weapons of regimes throughout Africa. There is a U.S. military presence in the overwhelming majority of African countries now. For the U.S., if you look at why they're there, well, they think that their new enemy is China, and perhaps it is in terms of economic development. China has done a lot of very useful deals with many African countries. It has built a lot of infrastructure. It has taken resources. It has bought up land. But in return, it has built roads and bridges and so on. The point is, it hasn't fired a shot and hasn't sent a single soldier into Africa. But they are the perceived new enemy. As we move on through that, the new big lie, which was uttered here in Australia by a U.S. admiral who appeared yesterday. They often come here because they get such a warm welcome.
Yeah, you can keep
and them. He said that there was a new wall of China being built across the seas of Asia. So here we have a version, if you like, of Colin Powell's famous, infamous presentation to the United Nations Security Council or Reagan's on the threat in Nicaragua and Central America about a Soviet presence in Central America. Here's the latest version called A New Wall of China Being Built. These connections are terribly important, and I say they're obvious, but we really need to make them and to understand them. Otherwise, we'll lose complete control of much of our world, many of our governments already. So that's certainly how I see it.
John, I really appreciate it, and I was really interested when you mentioned Libya and you talked about an African bank and Gaddafi's ideas of going off really the U.S. dollar. And I recall that wasn't Saddam Hussein considering also not going off the U.S. dollar for selling oil?
Yes, that was a factor. I'm not sure it was the factor, but certainly that's a common story with so-called dissident oil-producing countries such as Venezuela and Libya and Iran and, as you point out, Iraq, that they threaten the dominance of the petrodollar. And I think that's part of it. Certainly, there's no question that the Middle East would not be in the state it's in. Well, there are two reasons. Israel-Palestine is clearly at the center of it. But oil is and fossil fuels are absolutely critical to understanding this part of the world. There just wouldn't be the rapacious interest. So that then makes sense. And as you point out, when Saddam Hussein threatened to do this, that was almost the last straw. And he went to a particular OPEC meeting where he, I think, announced this, that he was going to give up the petrodollar, give up U.S. dollars. That takes away a prop of U.S. power throughout the world. It's only one of them, but it's an important one.
Let's switch our attention to the Ukraine, because I think there is a fine example of American aggression and American lies. What do you think is the ultimate purpose of America's meddling in the Ukraine and having their government overthrown?
The ultimate purpose is to subvert and dismember Russia. Ukraine is an important borderland. Ukraine means borderland. It's like a highway to Russia. The Nazis found that. They swept across it to the Soviet cities. Ukraine, of course, was then part of the Soviet Union. There seems no doubt about this, that the ultimate aim is that the disorder and division in Ukraine will spill over into Russia and provoke those elements in Russia that want to bring down the present Russian government. The baseline for this is independence. It's whether or not you like the government is beside the point. Russia is a big independent country, as Iran is an independent country, as Venezuela is an independent country. Independence is intolerable. And on the scale of Russia's independence, it's very intolerable because it stands at the gates to Eurasia. And at the other end of Eurasia, of course, is China. And Russia is seen as an obstacle to continuing, enduring U.S. dominance. It's not just dominance. It's seen as another voice. Again, that almost a post-colonial voice in the way that China is, in the way that even Syria is. Now, as I say, you don't have to approve of these governments, but that's the way they are perceived. In other words, overthrowing the Russian administration is, I believe, the reason for this absolutely disastrous U.S.-engineered coup d'etat in Ukraine But above all, the encircling of Russia by a missile system, the biggest military build-up, which is the U.S. build-up, in Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Republic since the Second World War. Imagine, just for a second, all this happening on the Canadian border or the Mexican border. That's what it is. And this open threat and provocation and isolation of Russia, that has been succeeded to some degree, but because the Western media doesn't really report the news, its failure hasn't been reported, and that is the coming together of Russia and China, the strengthening of relations between those two powers that are now presenting a new power bloc, the very nightmare that the United States has had all these years. So that is the cause. I mean, the failure, again, has been turned into propaganda. There's no question that it was NATO's and the U.S.'s ambition to seize Crimea, and there'd be a NATO base there had they succeeded in doing so, and they weren't successful. This is playing with fire, playing with nuclear fire now. I mean, if you read carefully what Putin has said and what his people have said, their whole narrative has shifted now towards the acceptance that they might have to defend themselves. And that could easily come down to nuclear war. That's why the recklessness of this Obama adventure, this latest Obama adventure in Ukraine, is almost breathtaking.
Let me ask you something that struck me in your writing in your recent article. I always thought about Jimmy Carter, you know, he came in after the Vietnam War is over, so his hands were tied a little bit. And I always sort of liked him because he was a combination of weak and human rightsy, and there were no real wars that I saw under those 4 years that he was in office. And then you start talking a bit about Brzezinski and what his role was under Carter, and of course what it has been going forward. So I'd like to hear you talk about that a bit.
Well, I remember I reported Carter. I reported quite a few U.S. election campaigns, and I think Carter was, Carter's 76 win was one of them. I remember here we go again, all the hopes, and yes, he seemed to be and is undoubtedly a decent and reasonable human being. But on Carter's watch, when he was president, let me deal with first Kissinger, who was hung over into that administration.
He's still around. He's advising Scott Walker.
Yeah, I know. Well, I saw a wonderful bit of YouTube the other day where some very courageous young man tried to arrest him. and I was cheering. But unfortunately, he wasn't taken into custody, so he's still at large. But he sent illegally weapons to East Timor.
That's right.
The Carter administration. East Timor was invaded with Kissinger's nod to Suharto and Gerald Ford's nod to Suharto when they visited Jakarta in 1975. In 1976, when Carter came to power, the arms flowed. And it was a former, rather brave CIA officer who appeared in one of my films, William Lichty, who was the CIA man on the desk in Jakarta and saw these arms flow in and what they were doing to the people of East Timor, where Suharto massacred a third of the population. So that happened under Carter's watch. But perhaps the most significant was the appointment of Brzezinski as national security advisor to Carter. So here you had this apparently very liberal president and this very illiberal national security advisor, who in 1979, the last year of Carter's administration, persuaded Carter to authorize secret arms to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And through the 80s, this grew into $500 million worth of arms. And of course, the Mujahideen lit really the whole fire of so-called jihadism in that part of the world. So that began under Carter. And it began with Brzezinski, who, of course, is like Kissinger. The two of them have been gurus to various administrations since then. And Brzezinski's The Grand Chessboard, his book, is regarded by a lot of these think tanks as the manual for how you dominate the world. I'm afraid that, you know, one of the last obstacles is to knock over the good old liberal delusions about these people. Obama's ascendancy succeeded in virtually getting rid of the anti-war movement in the United States, because everyone fell on their knees and said that God has arrived, finally, the liberal God. And that was total nonsense as well. So I think a lot of people understand that now, but it's important.
We're speaking with John Pilger on his new article in Counterpunch called Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue. And John, I wanted to ask you, Michael's got a last question, but I wanted to ask you about the ideology that underpins all this aggression, and that's the American exceptionalism. And you quote Obama saying, "I believe in American exceptionalism with every fiber of my being." Talk to us about that.
Yes, it's almost skin crawling to hear it, isn't it? Because, you know, my knowledge of it, I think probably my political education really began in the United States when I lived there and worked there. Exceptionalism itself is, you know, exceptionalism in Britain and Germany and all the countries that think that are taken over by certain ideologies regard themselves greatest human beings born. But American exceptionalism is one that is not recognized as such. And I've always felt that Americanism was the most unrecognized ideology. And it is the most powerful ideology in the world, and it is the predatory ideology. But it's not recognized. And even across the American Academy, you can see people, and I won't name them, fighting not to recognize Americanism for what it is. I think I started when if you begin to analyze this, you used to be called, not so much these days, anti-American, which is a very odd term. I mean, how can you be anti-American? It's ridiculous. But what they were saying was that you were anti-Americanism, and that's true. This is a predatory ideology. It is fueled by the fact that America is, on paper at least, a great democracy, and this kind of the brainwashing that supports it is itself unrecognized. That's very interesting, because it runs right throughout the media, right throughout the academy, with massive exceptions all over the place. That's why some of the greatest thinkers and opponents to it are in the United States. But it's whereas we look on other ideologies, they become headlines, you know, be it communism or fascism or Islamist extremism and all the other isms that are used. This ism is the most interesting, because it is the biggest, the most aggressive, and the most unrecognized.
And the most well-armed.
Well, you know, this current expression of Americanism as it pours arms and planes into the heroic Saudi Air Force as it attacks villages in Yemen, I read recently that that in spite of a global ban, the U.S. companies had supplied Saudi Arabia with $640 million worth of cluster bombs. Many of those would be dropped on Yemen. It has, over the last, I'm not sure what period, but something like $60 billion since the congressional ban on selling arms to Saudi was lifted, $60 billion in all kinds of horrific hardware has been sent to Saudi Arabia. That is, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is a critical component to it.
John, I want to conclude with a last question to you. And just before I do, I just want to recommend highly to people your website, johnpilger.com. It's remarkable. Of course, you can see not all 58 of your films on there, but I think you stream a number of them, as I recall, as well as a lot of your articles, books, etc. Highly recommended. And my last question, you end your article with what our responsibilities are and what we have to do as people who care about the issues you're talking about, and how we can at least try going forward to do better. And why don't you talk about how you're admonishing people at the end of the piece?
Yeah. Well, it's I think it comes down to ourselves. You know, you often get in audiences and talking about this, people saying, well, what can I do? Which is an extraordinary question, actually, in societies where there is a great deal of free information, like the United States and other Western countries. So people don't really have the excuse of not knowing, but you have to find out. And I think that's the first responsibility, is finding out. The second responsibility is, and then identifying and calling lies of governments, the lies of presidents, understanding the propaganda, deconstructing it, and understanding it to themselves, the recklessness of warmongers, and not, if you like, intellectually colluding with them or morally colluding with them. That goes on all the time. Good people do that. They collude with them. Oh, but it can't be that bad, that kind of thing. Because what is going on, really, with this propaganda and with this bloodletting throughout the world done in our name, is that it represents a conquest of us. And if we allow that conquest, and it's a conquest of our minds and humanity, self-respect, our sense of ourselves, if we allow that conquest, in other words, and this goes back to so many great and awful events in the recent past, that if we remain silent, then the conquest succeeds. Now, it's people, understanding that if they're prepared to be actually taken over by this power, controlled by it and by its propaganda, then that conquest succeeds. That should be unacceptable.
With those wise words, we conclude the program, and we thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder, and we hope that you'll join us again.
Hope to see you soon, John.
I'll be delighted. Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.